everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors for you. One is the SVG Summit. That's the URL as well, svgsummit.com. It's one of Environments for Humans' live conferences on the internet, live on the internet. It's coming up January 21st, and it's all about SVG. Check out svgsummit.com and lynda.com,
lynda.com.
Yep, that's going to be a good one. I think we really kind of nailed the harmony on that one. Challenge yourself.
That's the closest we've been in months.
Yeah, pretty solid. We just don't practice, you know? It's always game time when we do it. Challenge yourself to learn something new with a free 10-day free trial if you go to lynda.com/shoptalk. Classes on all kinds of web stuff. So probably the world's largest online learning resource for web stuff and tangential stuff. We're going to tell you more about both those things later in the show, but for now, Dave, hit the button. Just did.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, and today is a very exciting show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Quay. And Chris, who do we have with us today?
Oh, it really is a good one. It's kind of a mini panel, because it's not just one guest. It's not just two guests. It is the hosts of everybody's favorite online HTTP code-inspired learning podcast of fun. Oh my gosh, where am I going with this? It's HTTP 203's host, Jake Archibald.
Hello.
And Paul Lewis.
Hello.
Yes. It's the... That... Yes.
That's their theme song. We had to do two. You know.
We just,
that's the only time people have cheered us entering anything, I think. It sounded like it.
Normally leaving.
Yeah, they're normally like, oh, no, not these two idiots again. It's Let's go.
Just a collective groan.
I'm kind of flawed by the sort of professionalism of the intro so far. I don't feel we can... Because this is why we could never have sponsorship on our podcast, because I mean, it's not just the Britishness.
No.
It's the Britishness multiplied by just our general dourness.
Yeah. No, we could never do anything other than, yeah, I suppose you could use it, it's all right. Yeah. I mean, if you want to. You don't have to. I mean,
oh no, you can't do that. No.
No,
I like our sponsors anyway, because that's kind of a prerequisite for being a sponsor, but man, do I get stoked about sponsors. You're gonna love them, yeah. Okay. There's a lot people should and could and probably do and somewhat don't know about you two. I mentioned you as the host of HTTP 203, but there's a decent chance that you know of both of you gentlemen, don't even know that you do that show. So I guess the background to that is you both work at and for Google on the Chrome team and as a part of that do this show. Is that the case? Can you back us up on that stuff?
Yeah, we're a couple of DevRel people. Working on Chrome, and we decided that we should do some videos to try and, you know, do some kind of short videos on whatever subject we're thinking of at the time.
Yeah.
And it always just happens that we want it to happen in a pub.
Yeah, weird that. It's really bizarre. Don't know.
Well, there was one on a roller coaster, wasn't there? I mean, that's good. They didn't serve drinks on the roller coasters.
But we were drunk at the time, so it's okay.
Drunk. We really weren't. But the actually, because the last one that, yeah, we did this last season out in the States, because we were already going to be out for Google I.O. And so Nilesh, who's the person on our end who arranges all this stuff, was like, hey, why don't we like make your next series in America? And we were like, that's sure. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we got to go on a roller coaster. We got to do all sorts of crazy things, didn't we?
We filmed on a lake.
On a lake. At a football stadium. A hand egg stadium. I mean, it's not... People don't play football, but
they throw the kind of the sort of weird oval, 3D oval.
They're
thing
not
around.
A real rugby ball.
That's right.
Okay.
But we filmed one on a lake, and that was good fun because we were in a little rubber dinghy. But we were really late on getting the shoot ready, and we had to rush off to the next shoot. And we were in so much of a rush that we didn't actually have time to let the rubber dinghy down. Oh, we were trying. And then the producer just got so annoyed at how long it was taken. He just walked over and pulled a knife out of his pocket, which I assume he carries everywhere. And he shanked the boat to death.
I was really disappointed by that, because when he started doing it, I was hoping he was going to do the cartoon like...
and just shoot over
the lake.
Yeah.
But it just went.
Yeah, it was sort of a sad murder.
It was
good radio.
It was like bye bye dingy. We never really knew you.
Yeah, I wanted to give it a hug afterwards.
Really? That would have been strange. I would have enjoyed to see that you try that one.
I just wanted to stroke its head under its last
minutes. Move on. See, this is the problem. This is also a reason why we edit heavily. And in fact, we record for about 3 hours to get 5 minutes of footage. Yeah. True story.
Well, we don't have that luxury in for it. Maybe we can go. But this is all good stuff, gentlemen. But so that's part of the show. I mean, that was an extended escapade for just one episode of HTTP 203. You're in season three now, and you know, for people that haven't listened to it, it's video as well. Pretty high production value. The latest episode I'm looking at here is the future of JavaScript. There's also one, maintainable code, monoculture, and up in season two, performance, progressive loading, HTTPS everywhere. Things that we can talk about in this show a bit too. But yeah, people are interested in those subjects. Check it out. It's pretty easy to Google.
I see what you did.
HTTP 203. Yeah.
Boom. Yeah, I think that's actually worked in our favor now. I think if you Google for HTTP 203, it's gone up from
is that slightly good for the web?
If you're returning a 203, I don't know anybody who's ever returned an actual 203. Somebody must have done somewhere along the line, but now when they try and remember why, they're going to find us two idiots staring back at them going, "Have you ever thought about why this is annoying on the web?"
Oh, our show website should return that status code. Like, why don't we do that?
We should look at that.
Yeah, because it's not like an error code.
Now it can't be an Easter egg.
Oh, my God.
Well done.
Edit that out.
Yeah. Well, it's live.
Can you not edit live out?
The benefit is that nobody really listens to the show.
My main regret is that you can't edit live. Like, there's so many times in my life I was like, I would edit that if I could. Like, pretty much every time I open my mouth in public, right?
Yeah, every time you open your mouth in public, I wish we could undo time as well.
It sounds like it'd be a decent sci-fi show, you know, like you have a little remote control that you found in like an ancient pyramid or something that allows you to do that.
Yeah, that thing where you have an argument with someone and you lose and then you sort of walk away angrily and you're like,
ooh, let's try that.
Oh, hang on. Hey, excuse me, can you come back? Look, start from your second line because I've got some new material. I'd like to work in.
I've got an actual defeater. Let's move on. Yeah.
So we are talking with Jake Archibald and Paul Lewis. If you're just joining us now, Jake at jakearchibald.com, Jaffa the Cake on Twitter. You all have interesting Twitter handles. Paul Lewis is Aero Twist, A-E-R-O, Twist, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, because it turns out I'm not the only Paul Lewis, which I found horrendous at the time I discovered it. You know, I realized I was not a snowflake.
I'm not even the only Jake Archibald.
Really?
I'm going to find these people and I'm going to do a murder.
Well, it happened to my, we were out at the pub with one of my buddies who it doesn't even matter what his name was, because I can't remember, because it was one of his friends. And he's just like, I was just invited to a Facebook group. And it was like, you know, Leviticus Smith invited all other Leviticus Smiths to this Facebook group just to tell him to frick off.
Is he from Middle Earth? That's amazing.
Well, that's a great name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I feel really dour with a name like Paul Lewis.
Yeah. I feel like my name sounds more posh than I actually am. Which,
Jake Archibald.
It sounds like I should live in a castle and shoot arrows at the Scottish.
Yeah, it does actually.
Hmm.
But it all depends on how you deliver the name, because if it's just like Jake Archibald, that's never going to sound. But Jake Archibald.
Yes. Archibald of the Manor.
Shooter of arrows.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I feel like we can make that land. We should try that at some point.
Hmm.
Yeah. We rode roughshod. But yeah, it turns out that the other Paul Lewises are actually pretty famous as well. There's like a famous pianist, and the other one is a famous journalist as well. So
I think of you as a massive pianist.
The only other Dave Rupert, well, there are other Dave Ruperts in America who are very similar to me. Like, they play guitar, have beards. It's kind of weird. But there was a Dave Rupert who was in MI6. Is that your security agency? He's an MI6 agent who infiltrated the IRA. So there's, like, lots of death threats to kill Dave Rupert over in the UK. And so
I can't help but feel that if you work in MI6 and you're Googleable,
there's something that's gone a little wrong.
Yeah, you're failing at your job.
A friend of my brother's is actually called Edward Snowden. That didn't work out well for him. Yeah, I know.
Someone's not getting into the US ever again.
Well, that was the thing. It was, you know, when it all kind of came out, all that stuff, he got quite a few messages on Twitter of a less than pleasant nature. So it does happen. Names. Yeah.
Traitor.
Yeah. Well, that's so a hard segue into HTTPS. Let's.
Wow, that was, it was effortless, that wasn't it? Mm. It's like one of our shows.
It was, yeah. Good.
I feel a little selfish here. I feel like now that we have you two, there's so many things that we can extract from you, interesting things. In 2014, I went to the Chrome Dev Summit, and didn't get a chance to go this year, sadly, but we're just off the heels of it, I believe. And that's for you two, that's probably a lot of work. I think you kind of MC the thing, and it's kind of the culmination of a year's worth of work as Chrome dev people, right? So as somebody who missed it, and I'm just catching up on the notes and stuff, maybe you could do some highlights for us or like, well, what were the big cool things?
So I'm just going to – immediately, go on, get out of your system.
Well, service worker was mentioned. There was also a little bit of service worker in there. Mm-hmm. One of the talks covered service worker. There was a panel.
On service worker.
It was mostly about service worker.
It turns out that Jake does only have two tricks, one of which is service workers.
So who worked on service workers? Was it a Chrome, a Blink thing? And not, because it sounds like pretty much everybody's interested in it and probably going to do it. Does that take a little like shoulder rubbing, or does it just need to be a good idea, or what? You know, service workers are going to be useless unless all the browsers pick them up, right? Isn't that like one of the struggles with new tech?
Well, I mean, service worker came about by I remember a meeting organized by Andrew Betts at the FT where we all sat around a table and went, "So,
what if?"
Well, it was more like, "So, AppCache is pooplops. What are we going to do about that?" And there was sort of vague idea about, well, maybe it should be a JavaScript thing. And so Alex Russell and I kind of stared at a whiteboard for what seemed like forever. And then we sort of threw an API design out. And then, you know, Mozilla was super keen on it. Samsung got interested and you know, much smarter people took our scrawlings and started, you know, forming it into a kind of full spec. And what, you know.
So it was cross company really early.
Oh, yeah, definitely, which I think is kind of what everything should be, because there's nothing that gets on a browser's nerves more than another browser coming and going, hey, we've got a complete solution, don't change anything, just implement it.
I'm very interested in that, because you work for Google, and it's like this, you know, what's kind of, I don't know, like, is it ever tempting at Google? Is there, like, discussions where, like, man, I so wish that we could just develop this feature and push it out in Chrome, because it would be so awesome. But we know that if we do that, that leads us to a browser wars-like scenario, which we know isn't good for anybody, and, you know, there's kind of what's good for the web is good for Google kind of sentiment.
When we forked Blink, one of the sort of rules, the guiding rules that we had in there that was right super important to me was that we wouldn't do that, and that we have this kind of picture of you know, to force a feature to ship, these things need to happen, and vendor interest from other browsers is one of those guiding principles. So, you know, we can't just walk up and go, hey, we built this thing last night, it's going into the browser. Like, it, you know, we have these principles that sort of... Get in our way in a good way.
But you'd imagine that the temptation is there. That's all I'm saying, is that it's hopefully as the years tick by, that sentiment that you have now, that no, we won't do that. I don't want to do that. It's important that we don't do that. Hopefully that doesn't erode, you know?
Oh, of course. But it's, I mean, there's always a temptation, right? And it's that's why we have rules and like brains and things to sort of stuff that happening.
Well, you technically don't have a anyway.
Well, do you ever get that thing where I mean, I hope I'm not outing myself as a psychopath here, but like when you're sort of walking along like, you know, a train platform or something, and someone's standing there, part of your brain's going, push him.
No.
You don't get this.
I'm glad we have this. I'm going to move just a little further away from you.
No, but I you know, you sort of walk, or things like you know, if you're at like a deep fat fryer, like part of your brain is like, put your hand in it.
Oh, always like I'm walking across a bridge and I've got my phone in my hand.
Fling it.
Throw the phone.
Fling the phone. Yeah,
Why not?
Get that as well.
Yeah. You actually did it.
No, I know, but I get that feeling.
Yeah, it's a weird feeling.
And I feel like there's a very fine line.
There's a German word for it, and I forget what the German word is, but it's like the voice
Call of the Void.
Yeah, Call of the Void or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And it just sort of kind of, it kind of tries to, I mean, German's brilliant for capturing that sentiment in probably a single word, but yeah, it's that very, very much that kind of, yeah, it's a bizarre thing that the brain does there.
So I'm sure there's a Call of the Void to, oh, we could just change the div tag to, you know, for every div tag on the page, the browser will do a little meow sound. And I'm sure there's a temptation to do that, but we don't. And for every release of Chrome where there isn't a meow sound, you know we're sticking to those rules.
Yeah. It's just interesting. We're just kind of off the heels of you know, Jeffrey Zeldman every year has this blue beanie day thing, which in the early days kind of meant like, you know, put your cap on and fight for web standards. And I thought over the years, then I kind of wrote a piece years ago that was kind of like, we kind of won that war. It's feeling a little like browsers these days almost compete on, look at how well we support standards. That's almost like a marketing message for browsers these days. So it's kind of like we won that war. But then I was like, so maybe the blue beanie day should just be kind of celebrating the fact that the web standards are cool and we should think about them. But now I'm thinking, you know, we really need to be vigilant about this kind of thing. Maybe these kind of this celebration could be the watchman, you know, like who we need to stay vigilant at.
I completely agree with that, because I think that one of the wars that I thought was won is the progressive enhancement war. But then it unwon when I wasn't looking.
What happened? So we were doing really well, and then JavaScript. I'm going to blame John Rezig for jQuery.
I think jQuery for me is still in the land of kind of convenience, and you can switch it out. I, as you might have come across, had, I think its frameworks generally seem to be the undoing of us a little bit at the moment, where there's this
backbone
kind of,
then.
Actually, Backbone Tank in my test came out okay, but I know, right? But it's more like this idea that like the convenience of just getting a thing shipped has kind of got to the point where sometimes the cost of it is really, really high on the user side, like the amount of bandwidth and CPU and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, in order to get anything on the screen, we got to get all that JavaScript down the wire, and it's got to build the whole page. And progressive enhancement doesn't really fit into that story, because it's going from like, it's a binary state of I've got nothing on screen to I've got everything on screen and nothing in between until the framework's ready. And so it's actually, what's interesting is seeing that the client-side frameworks are now starting to shift more towards we can work with server-side rendered things and start to enhance those things again.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's a very welcome kind of return to back to this progressive enhancement form that we used to have, I think.
This is the thing that bothers me about it. Because like, when we talk about like, you know, some the framework patterns that we don't like, we're not saying frameworks are bad. It's kind of the current set of frameworks have big problems. And one of the problems is they from the outset, they take away a lot of the benefits of the web. And that really worries me. Like they start, you know, they take note from last decade's native apps, that this whole idea, well, surely we have to load absolutely everything before we can do anything. And native apps are busy reversing their position on that, because it's like, oh, this is slow, especially on mobile. Meanwhile, the web is like, no, the 90s, that sounds great. Let's do that. We need to make all those mistakes ourselves. And I with server rendering and with like some of the frameworks starting to think about streaming a bit more.
That's his other trick, by the way.
Streaming. I love streams. Very excited about streams. That we could get to a point where like frameworks are actually, you know, using the advantages of the web to their advantage.
What?
I know, right? What? How crazy would that be? So maybe.
So it's like you won't make a mistake if you have solid server side action happening. You know, all your routes work server side. It spits back all the right stuff server side. Like that seems like a solid investment for any website, and then kind of enhance from there. I think that feels right to me.
I mean, I care less about what's right and what's wrong, but more just what's fast. And I've never seen a client render beat a server render. I mean, under decent network conditions, like even with like a service worker there getting you to first render like quickly with cached assets, it sometimes struggles to beat a server render, because if you've got a good network connection, getting from the network can be faster than getting from disk, especially if JavaScript's in the middle. And we're kind of looking at ways of like, this is 2016, it's going to be streams. We're looking at how to sort of embrace that. So even a service worker can start pushing, you know, content down, and the browser can start rendering it before it has everything in place. That's That's what I'm excited about.
Like, wow, I know that's the kind of thing that worries Dave a little bit. I know that's been crossing your mind, Dave, lately. It's the kind of new thing, got to worry about the new thing. New thing, got to worry about the new. It's like, it seems like new things that like is it become part of like, you got to do this now.
Ready? Yeah.
Why don't
I feel like Google specifically is telling me you have to do this now. And now, surprise, this is now your job. And surprise, you have to do this or because we're grading you and don't mess it up. And so that's been a point of, I don't know, just sort of like is Google always right is my big question. And I would like to address that here. True or false, Google is perfect. So my thing is like, you know, we're making a big push towards critical CSS, and critical CSS is a pretty awesome technique. But you know, it's been standardized, quote unquote, via page speed insights and how your page is graded. They like rank that like with like a 20, 30 points because like painting in the first request is a huge deal. But the like flip side of that is now I have to like do cookies and stuff to like load a website normally.
So that's very interesting because we're, you know, I think that pattern is going to hopefully, we're doing work to make that go away. Okay, to address your earlier point, is Google always right? God, no. Like for instance, there are teams at Google who are sort of working in opposite directions. So it's kind of as a question, it disproves itself. Because there's parts of Google saying, hey, you know, Android is the answer to everything. And there are parts of Google saying, hey, the web is the answer to everything. So, I mean, Google, by that definition, cannot be right because it's saying two different. Well, I mean, I guess it must be right because it's one of those things.
Yeah, it's hedging its bets anyway.
I think that one of the things that came out of Chrome Dev Summit this year was this idea of progressive web apps, which is the idea is, I mean, Alex Russell, I think, has pitched this very much as this is a website that you would have built anyway that is cross-browser, that just does the right things, but it took the right vitamins as well. So it can kind of do the push messaging, it can do offline, it can do all these kind of extra things that we think are in the user's benefit. And ultimately, that will help developers. I think what a lot of this stuff comes from, whether it's, you know, inlining the CSS or anything, page speed insights, anything like that, it's trying to drive at what's good for the user. It is the kind of guiding principle, really, is like sometimes doing what's right for the user is going to mean that we have a less convenient time than we would have had otherwise as developers. And I feel that myself as well. Like some days, you know, you're bombarded by this is going to be ES 2015 or 2016. Have you heard about async await yet? What about, are you inlining everything? Did you switch on HTTP2? You know, there's like a million and one questions. And we have, as an industry, kind of moved on from, I think, like, hey, I'm just Paul in my little bedroom at home, hacking on something that I'm going to push to the web, and that'll be my thing. And what I think is that still works, that you can still build for the web. The thing that you built 10, 15, 20 years ago, it might not be great, but it's still going to work, or it should work on today's modern web, depending on what you actually chose to do at the time. And so it's just one of those things.
It degrade a little bit because you didn't buy an SSL certificate, so now you're starting to accumulate some penalties for the fact that that hasn't happened, and you know, you're not going to benefit from any of the HTTP2 stuff. And I don't know, like
your web still works, right?
I mean, it still works,
right? You can still request over HTTP, you know, and it still renders and hopefully still does the right. If you still got a table based layout, that should still work.
Yeah. If you choose to ignore every advancement in the web for the past 10 years, the great news is what you build will still work. But if, you know, like, other people use more modern web features and create a better user experience, then got no sympathy for you.
The user kind of wins in that situation.
Exactly.
I think that for me is, I keep coming back to that, my life may be a little more sort of hard, but I would rather that the human beings at the end of the day who are looking at the thing I made had a better time doing that. And I think as well, like, technology's moved on and people do expect more from their devices. And, you know, everybody should want to, I think, keep a close to that. And especially as a developer, you know, if it's your full-time job and you're able to do that, which not everybody can, but if you are, then you know, it's great to try and keep up with some of those trends, at least to kind of know where we're going. And I think what's unique about the web as well is that we as developers are also in a position to shape that future. Like every vendor I know of loves getting the feedback from actual real world developers saying, this is how we think this should play out. I mean, you know, that, like Jake said, Service Worker was born out of the fact that Andrew Betts, who is a developer, went, hey, you know, that offline thing, that kind of doesn't work. Can we fix that? And okay, that's a lot of work for a lot of people and it's involved a lot of parties along the way, but really the idea came from a developer. Yeah. And that's the truth. You know, all the working groups, all the mailing lists, all those things where people kind of chime in and say, you know what, this is important to me. I think it should go like this. I think, was Promises another one? Promises, I feel, was that born out of?
I mean, that was born out of Service Worker as well, because we wanted to do things async in a kind of sensible way.
Okay. Sensible-ish. Yeah, I have a thing about Promises at the moment. They kind of drive me a little bit mad. I feel like if 10 was like pure coding happiness that I wanted to write, callbacks is kind of a 1 out of 10, but I'm finding that Promises is putting me at about a 4 or a 5.
Use async functions.
I know, async gonna wait. I'm actually down with. I was giving those a play today. Those are much more like what I want, because it reads like synchronous code again.
Synchronous code.
Yay, but it actually is asynchronous code, so the computer's happy and I'm happy, and that is the way it should be.
I was going to say, before we get too far away from the critical CSS thing, that is something I wanted to talk about. Because Chris, I hear you're into CSS, right? That's
some tricks.
You like that thing.
I haven't really gone down this particular path, though, yet. It's felt a little awkward to me, and I just haven't been completely convinced that it's the right way to go. But anyway.
So, well, we've been working on a sort of different way of serving CSS in Chrome. Like we think the critical CSS stuff is really difficult to get right. So we're interested in a model where, you know, you pages are all built of components. By which I don't mean web components, I just mean sort of like conceptual, like that is a comment box, that is a set of links that look in a particular style. And we're wanting to move to this model where you'll put a link element just before the first instance of a component on your page. So, and the idea is these link elements, like pointing to style sheets just as they do today, will block everything after them from rendering. So you can have just like a link element just for your header, right at the top of the header, that can download really quickly and render, and then you'll have another one for your article, and then that will render. So rather than waiting, but it kind of comes back down to what we were saying before, rather than this all or nothing approach where you have to wait for everything to get something, you're kind of progressively downloading your CSS as well. And that's an amazing Chrome innovation that we stole from Internet Explorer.
Just like how Safari invented scroll snap points from Internet Explorer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, so this is something that Internet Explorer has done as long as we remember. Like a link element, if you put it in the body, the spec doesn't say what to do, but they block the rendering of anything after that rather than blocking everything. We block everything at the moment.
It's a little confusing to me. Is this a theoretical link element, or really you're talking about straight up an anchor link?
No, sorry, a link element, L-I-N-K.
Oh, a link element. Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Link rel style sheet.
Yep.
So,
I see.
So then from an authoring perspective, I need to just be mindful of whatever the like header and first component of that page is on every single page, include that inline in the head, and then
No, we want to get away from inline. Inline is a hack around the limitations of HTTP/1.
Okay.
So the idea is you reference an external file, your page will have lots of little CSS files rather than one big monstrous one, and they'd be peppered throughout your page just before the element that needs them.
Oh, clever. Just like how a JavaScript module might be like a chunk of HTML and then right after it, a script element.
Exactly. But this is before, so the link
element
will block.
Hold. Yeah, so you don't see anything that doesn't work.
Yeah, yep. So in the way link elements already block, but at the moment they just block everything.
Oh, they just block the node that it's in? Like, would you put div, link, rest of the stuff, close div, and then it would block just inside that div? That would be weird.
It doesn't just block inside the div, it'll block any subsequent elements. So, you know, not just inside that element, but everything else. So, you know, because we don't want this situation where, you know, your comment section loads first and then the article loads and then pushes the contents, the comment section down.
I see.
We want a very sort of progressive loading experience rather than a kind of shifting around.
So Source Order gets wicked important again.
Well, Source Order is already wicked important.
Yeah, sure. Cool. Let's see. I can do a sponsor, and then I can smoothly usher us into a similar conversation. One of those sponsors is lynda.com, lynda.com. Go to /shop, talk to. That's how you can sign up for the free 10-day free trial, which means that you get access to their absolutely everything on lynda.com for those 10 days. So we've said in the past, and I really like this as kind of a cool idea. If you, especially because it's coming into the holidays, and some people have to, like, you know, travel home to Iowa or whatever to have, you know, Christmas with their family, which they kind of want to do, but they're kind of dreading it too because it's going to be boring or something. Like, just sign up for the 10-day free trial and, like, make a couple of playlists for yourself of some stuff that you want to level up on and take advantage of the free trial. And then, you know, if you love it, which you probably will, then you can stay signed up. One of the things that you can do, lynda.com/playlist center is a thing I found recently that they do pretty well. They make, you know, the people that work at Lynda make curated playlists of, like, related topical things. So it's not just entirely on you to go trolling around and finding the things that you want to do. If you're, like, interested in illustration, want to learn logo design, they have a playlist of courses that are on lynda.com to watch about designing a logo or becoming an interaction designer or what's another one here? Communicate clearly. You know, I wish my girlfriend would watch that one. Hey-o!
What? I need a full drum set for that one.
Anyway, that's lynda.com/shoptalk. Check it out. Where I want to go with this is that, okay, so there's all this new stuff. We've mentioned service workers, and now streams are coming along, and we've thrown out HTTPS and how important that is lately. HTTP2 is coming, very fascinated. We've talked a little bit about critical CSS. Is it going to stick around? Is it not? Because we have Paul here who's made CSS triggers, we're kind of, it's one of those things that you should probably be aware of is repaints and reflows and how that goes, and just performance in general, and related to performance is stuff like responsive images. And then there's, like, we talked about promises, like, what is ES6? What is ES7? Should I be thinking about this stuff? We know that people are overwhelmed because we know as a show, people write in like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I can't go on like this.
Before we get onto the next topic, I'm kind of, we've had some, you know, we've been gathering some letters from people in England.
Because to be clear on this, you know, we have our questions for you too. You don't get off scot-free. There are questions from England for you. Okay. All right. So so you can't just kind of ride roughshod for the whole thing and think you're getting away with it. No. Here we go.
This seems fair. So, this seems fair.
Call a moratorium on questions.
Oh.
Denied.
So, here's our first letter. Dear Americans, that's you guys. I was recently in an America and I needed to go to the toilet. And that is where I went. But while I was there, I noticed that the gap between the door of the toilet was about 3 foot wide. And I could see all and everyone, and they could see me. What is with that, and why, and how? But, yeah, I mean, if
you kind of make eye contact with someone through the crack.
Right, you know? Right. Yes, yeah, not even through the crack. I mean, you could put a whole limb through there and wave and things.
Is it kind of harking back to the Wild West times? You want a little saloon door?
Yeah. I think cost is part of it. I mean, not that I can totally defend it, because I will tell you, traveling to Europe, it feels very nice and private in those booths, and I do enjoy that. But I'll tell you one thing I like is, like, let's say you have like a luggage or something at the airport. When the door doesn't close all the way, you can kind of wheel your luggage in there and kind of leave it against the door. And it's kind of a visual symbol that somebody's in there, so I don't have to jiggle the handle. I think jiggling the handle...
That feels like you're working around the issue and avoiding the question there, so no.
Because the visual symbol is the little red thing.
Yeah, the one that says locked.
And also that you put your hand on it and the door doesn't move.
Yeah, typically.
Yeah.
I just would like to point out that America has a long history of great craftsmanship. So I think that it was probably very intentional and done by a very skilled craftsman.
Yeah. It's a good idea. Let's not talk about it. I'm sure it's not a good idea.
I'm glad that sometimes when I'm on the toilet, I'm able to shake hands with someone outside.
It feels like a real team thing.
Yeah.
It's good. Have you got another question? You look like you've got another letter there, Jake.
Yes, okay. Dear Americans, that's still you two. I was in a pub in America, and I needed to go to the toilet. I think this might be from the same person.
It feels like it might be related.
Yeah. And when I went in there, it was a large room big enough to do a series of cartwheels in, and there was a toilet, the kind of a normal toilet, and also a urinal.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these devices I am familiar with and know how to use, but they were behind a single locked door.
Oh.
Like they were there as some sort of
That's the exception, choice. Not the rule, I would say.
This is the rule, not the exception, is the next line.
It's strange. It's like you're making this up on the fly.
I have been in queues in American bars where I have had to create a buddy system with strangers in order to get the queue down quickly. Why?
Here's another one, yeah. though, just related. If the door closes so perfectly and so solidly and so privately, doesn't it kind of encourage like some like possibly more unsavory behavior in those things? Like if the fact that you can see through the gap, ain't nobody doing
more
anything in there but
you taking a big old turd.
I understand this predicament. You walk into a bathroom, it's very unclear, is this a group bathroom because there's more than one facility, or is this a single use, a single occupant facility? And it is, I would agree, it's very confusing, but I do think, you know, if you're on a buddy system, if you know the people, it's maybe fine. It's camaraderie in the bathroom, but in general,
kind of
yeah,
a frat
it's
party
sort of
where
spooky.
You have your buddy in, and they go in the sink, and you go in the you know, because it's just that important.
I was in a restroom similar to that one time on a road trip, so you know it wasn't good, and somebody the door just opened up. I spent a good 5 minutes locking, and the door just opened up, and my response there in all my vulnerability was just sorry. I locked it.
Sounds like you. That sounds like you. With the kind of squeeze your gut as you say it. I can imagine the emails from this be like, they had a good conversation going, and then it went straight to poop.
Potty.
Yeah.
Straight down the
That's
potty.
That's because the Brits were involved.
Yeah. We could talk about the web, I suppose.
Why? When this is so enthralling. Let's talk about the web. You had questions. I feel like we have we've had passable answers to our questions.
They
have
very good answers.
I feel like we've I'm not just so in Europe. There's weird toilet things
still
as well.
Went
like
on. Okay,
there's I you go to European hotels and in the bathroom there's a telephone next to it.
Really?
Yeah. Have you not noticed in Germany especially? Because you can phone reception. You can phone another room. And go hi. What are you doing? Well, you can tell by how quickly I answered the phone that I'm doing the same thing you are. Yeah. Well.
Oh, but it makes you... I've got more questions than I have answers now, Jake.
I'm sorry.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, yeah, the web.
Yeah. What's your take on this whole... this whole web thing? No, I mean, do you feel like, from your point of view, that it is running away with you, that it is getting too complicated to build for the web, that we should... You know, PPK called for his moratorium. That big old hiatus. Which side were you on?
I don't disagree on any particular points we've made so far, but I can have empathy towards that feeling of being overwhelmed, and I can envision a future in which that, let's say we did, even though there's no chance that this is ever going to happen, but let's say we did have a moratorium on feature, and everybody kind of caught up a little bit. You know, we got a chance to learn the existing things and whatever. And I don't know if that's how it would actually play out. I don't know if anybody would get any smarter. I don't know if things would settle down anymore. But it seems I can envision a future where that's the case, and it kind of almost feels like our industry might be a little bit more mature if that was the case. We could start having, you know, some standardized testing or something that's like, okay, this is the way things are on the web, so that we can ask the right questions and expect the right answers and stuff, and not have this be this ever moving yardstick of the things that you're supposed to know. I know that Jake feels very differently as the if we stand still, we go. Mm-hmm.
Well, my question to you on that is: did you feel that happened during the IE6 days?
I don't know. I was barely around, I guess. But yeah, you're right. I suppose
I was.
Yeah,
his face just went really
story time.
Oh, no, it was just a... Well, I built a career out of knowing all of IE6's quirks. which I guess is a form of catching up.
I mean, that would be admitting that the current state of things is as bad as that, which I don't think anybody thinks.
No, it's not. It's not. But a moratorium.
But if we stopped, it might.
That's, like if you paused it and there were no new features, then, you know, I wonder if, say, people did catch up, if there is that sense that people want to catch up, and then you hit play again, you know, do you, is it like 5 years on, 1 year off? What about the people who are new to the web? They've still got a massive surface area to kind of cover to even feel like they're even able to be productive.
Which is why this whole thing is theoretical, right? Like, nobody's actually thinking that we should actually pull the trigger on this. A, there's no freaking way it's even possible, so...
I think for me, it's like the back to the like, hi, you have more new jobs to do. That's what gets me down. Like HTTP2, I said it right, is fascinating. Wow. Awesome. It like fetches everything. Like I don't have to like concatenate sprite sheets.
And I don't know about you, but I have no idea how to get started on it. I would like to turn it on right now. No, I'm convinced it's the way to go, but I have no idea how to get started.
But so it's like, that's awesome. And then people are like, server push, and you push a thing down. And it's like, well, how does server push work? Well, you do like this amazing configuration file. And it's like, oh God, I have another thing to do. And then like, I'm looking at an article right now, AMP HTML. Oh God, I have another thing to do to make a thing fast for a thing. This just sucks. Can we stop this train? Because I had a lot to do, and now I just have more and more things to do. I have like every time I add a new grunt task, it's just like, oh God, here's another thing I have to do.
I mean, these things will definitely get easier over time. I mean, if you think back to sort of the early days of the web, just getting something onto the web, like you were doing FTP via, you know, Telnet, the super base level stuff. But as these things became more popular, you got more tools and like build system to sort of do most of those tasks for you. And that'll happen with HTTP2 as well. And I think that, you know, CDNs are already starting to, you know, have adopted HTTP2, so it just does it all for you. And one of the things they're looking at right now, which I'm really excited about, is that if you, from your HTTP 1 server, send special headers, the CDN will interpret that as HTTP2 features like priority and push. And for me, that's great. It's like, oh, I don't have to deploy an HTTP2 server. I just tell the CDN, hey, when you serve this file, also serve this file. Job done.
Well, it's like
that was easy.
Progressive enhancement, HTTP2. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Oh, progressive enhancement is, HTTP2 is progressive enhancement. The way it happens is your browser says, hey, hello, I'm talking to you in HTTP1, but by the way, I support HTTP2. And the server goes, hey, actually, I speak that language. Let's carry on.
So the work that a developer has to do is only on your own server, because as soon as you support on your server, any browser that starts supporting it will benefit from it.
And the other thing is, even if you sort of build for H2 from the get-go, you know, it's still backwards compatible with HTTP1. Like, you can still serve, so long as the server can still serve HTTP1. Yeah. Like, yes, you're going to see more requests than you'd like, and we've built up all these patterns, but your stuff will still work. And so it's one of these moments where I think we sort of apply a lot of pressure to ourselves as well to be like, I must support all the things perfectly in all the ways since forever. But reality says, no, you're not going to be able to do that. You have to pick your battles. And there's some battles that are worth fighting and some that aren't, depending on what it is you're trying to build. Like, should I go to a framework? Should I go with H2? Should I do all these things or not? And obviously, it's difficult to make those calls unless you've tried those technologies and you know when they're good and when they're not. But I agree with Jake. I think over time, being able to even make the decision in the first place should get a lot easier. And right now, yeah, some of these things are in kind of early adopter phase, and they are going to be quite painful. And to some degree, I think we just kind of, I certainly feel like I should forgive myself a little bit for not being on top of absolutely every new everything that comes out all the time. And it's not healthy if people feel the other way, that they can't just kind of, you know, just build.
Isn't like, there a sense that it might actually, as much as we're like, oh, this is a new thing we have to learn, in the case of HTTP2, it may actually over time make things much simpler, right? Because you don't need module loaders anymore. You don't need to worry about spriting stuff. You have to worry about concatenation of files. We might not even compress files anymore, because most of the benefit is through, you know, kind of compressing through things like gzip anyway. So it may make things a lot easier.
Well, I think we need more data because, I mean, certainly the Khan Academy put out a blog post a week or two back, and they were saying, like, if you have just like every single thing as a single request, like that didn't work out well for them. And but there were like, I think it was 296 files, I think, was what they were doing, sending down the wire. And so, like, there's got to be a balancing act here. But
some of that is because browsers aren't yet optimized for that. I know there's actually a lot. I can't speak for other browsers, but I know in Chrome, having that many requests, it hits a little bit of a slow path for us right now.
Okay.
Because, you know, we haven't seen a lot of like these large amounts of tiny files all arriving at once. And it does cause a little bit of kind of, cross-process communication that slows things down. You know, we'll fix that at some point.
Yeah.
But
I was thinking, so along the service workers line, the thing that interests me the most, because it still feels like as much as people have been doing a good job about trying to explain it and stuff, it's complicated. It's complicated to me. It feels a little over my head. But I know one of the things that it's very good at doing is offline stuff, because you register a worker and it can respond even though the network has failed or whatever. That seems like the most compelling marketing point for service workers. And it also feels like close. Is there a better one?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, for me, it's not just the offline story. It's the online story as well. Like, I love the fact that whether I'm offline or online, my stuff will come from cache straight away. Uh-huh. So it is kind of related to the offline thing, but it's actually...
Is it faster than the cache we already get? You know, is that we already have cache online, right? The browser's just cache stuff.
It's roughly the same.
Yeah. But it's nice.
But you can code how, you know, what you want it to do, how you want it to interact with that cache. So with a service worker, you could say, hey, whenever the browser requests a URL that ends in .jpg on this page, I want you to respond with this GIF. And you can do that. And if that's something that's useful to you, great. If that makes your user experience better, then great. And that's really the fundamentals of how the offline stuff's built. It's like, you know, in the service worker, you hear, oh, someone's requested this HTML page. And rather than do the default of go to the network, you go, oh, actually, just send this thing from the cache back, whatever.
Yeah, that's cool. So somebody wanted to offer to kind of explain it and write a guest post for me at CSS Tricks. I was like, you know what we should do? I'll make you a little simple website. It's got SVG on it. It's got JavaScript on it. It's got HTML and CSS, of course. Let's just do what you need to do to make it work offline. And it was like, oh, this is perfect. You know, and it worked out great. And it exists and we have it. And it's an open GitHub repo. And it has like all its whole service worker implementation only exists in which to make sure that it works offline. It does nothing else. So it ends up as like kind of a good reference repo for that kind of thing. But it's a little, you know, it's a couple hundred lines of code to get that kind of thing done. It makes me think, like, is there a future of this thing in which that it's not that hard, that there's like a little module that you can be like, just make this thing work offline. You know what I want to do. I want you to save all the resources. Just save all the resources.
There are definitely a couple of people on our team who are looking at tools like this, Service Worker Precache and Service Worker Toolbox.
Yeah.
Both of which are designed to kind of say, like, there are common patterns, there are common things you want to do. Like, you just want to kind of go to network first and fall back to cache or vice versa or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to kind of get that to a stage where it's, you know, a gulp task.
And why doesn't Chrome just, why don't browsers just do that? Is there a compelling reason why they...
Well, it just do what?
Just be like, I've been to this static HTML page before. I know that I'm offline right now, but just you probably have a copy of it sitting around. Just let me see it.
What? So even if the server's responded with no cache, it should cache it and serve it?
I guess not. You know, if the server has said not to, then maybe not.
Well, a lot of HTML pages you'll find on the web are served with no cache. It's more of a tricky user experience issue because beyond anything than a simple demo, the offline experience isn't just serve me the last view I saw. Because like, imagine you're browsing around a website, you browse around the first two pages logged out, and then you log in, and now you know the pages have your username in the top right. And then if you start going back to other pages, sometimes it says you're logged out, sometimes it says you're logged in, all because the browser's making some assumption news. Like, I've got the right thing. So this is why we want to give this sort of low-level tools for developers to create user experience
the right
they
choices.
Want.
Yeah.
Well, we decided in Specland that we're rubbish at this. Like, we're rubbish at coming up with user experiences. Like, we tried it with... I mean, AppCache was the kind of canonical failure of this. It's like, oh, you want stuff to work offline? Well, we'll come up with the system where you type the least amount of code that results in huge amounts of behavior in the
background. So what I just described is for sure not a good idea.
Well, but someone could use AppCache, someone could use Service Worker even, to do what you just said. Like, they could create a little library that you just include the script, and it does what you said. I think you would struggle to find websites where it was doing the right thing. But this is what we want to see, is like, with all of the tools, like, hey, here's all the tools where you can do crazy stuff. You can like try all these user experiences. And then if we see like a library that everyone's using that does these patterns and it works great, but it's a little bit slow because it's written in a library rather than in the browser, we can go, oh, well, we can look at sticking that in the specification and make it faster. Which is kind of, all going back to things like query selector, everyone's doing this in jQuery and it's slow because it's in JavaScript. Let's bring it into the platform.
In a former life, I did a lot of WebGL work, and a similar story with like 3JS, basically. It was everybody, nobody who wanted to actually do meaningful 3D work would venture into WebGL just because it was just so hairy and just really low level and like this state machine that you didn't want to play with. But when 3JS came along, and you could make a WebGL renderer, and you could give it kind of objects that you'd have exported from your 3D package, all of a sudden this stuff became a lot easier. So, it doesn't always necessarily make its way back into the browser, although that does seem to happen sometimes. I think, generally speaking, it's like you go to the lower level thing first. You can definitely make the higher level things on top of that. If you go to the high level thing first, well, good luck. If it doesn't work out for your use case, it's going to be Hacktown and kind of workaroundsville, population U. Sad you, probably.
but this is the question people should be asking of browsers and standards process. Like, we know that when you visit a web page, when it's only downloaded a little bit of it, it can get something on the screen. We also know that you can download something using XHR or fetch, and you can get a string, and you can put that in an element using inner HTML. People should be asking questions like, well, if I've just received a little bit of that HTML, why can't I inner HTML that? And it do the right thing, streams. These are little bits of, yeah, and it's streams. but there's lots of stuff like that. I mean, Paul, you found it out, some stuff when you were doing audio work, right? Like encoding.
Yeah, that basically that you couldn't. What was it now?
You couldn't get access to the encoder?
Yeah, no, I couldn't. I really couldn't. There was the thing. It was all sorts of interesting things. Certainly in Chrome, like I could give an audio element, Ogg Opus. But I couldn't give it to the Web Audio API. That was one bizarre thing. And then you just couldn't say, look, I have this audio that I've got. Would you mind maybe just encoding it, seeing as you actually presumably can encode these things for WebRTC and can decode these things because I can give you the files? And there was no kind of user land. There's no like developer way of doing these things. And this, for me, is a lot of the frustration. Even if they are low level, even if it does increase the surface area, even if it does make our lives a bit more challenging, at least to begin with, there are plenty of people who I think show time and time and time again that they're willing to abstract these things in meaningful and helpful ways, but it does give us ultimately more power to express what we're trying to build for the user. And it's like, I want to be able to encode audio and save it to a data store. Yeah. And my feeling is that ideally the browser should give you the kind of, well, here's an encoder and here's a data store. And then we can do the kind of piping around bits that we're actually very good at because we know what we're trying to actually do with those individual primitives.
Yeah, because WebRTC has all of the audio. It has to have audio encoders, video encoders there to work. That's how it sends video across across the web. But like
you were going to say streams.
I was going to say streams.
Dude,
and I stopped myself.
It's like a broken record. Stream, stream, stream. Service worker. Stream, service worker.
But it means that why can't I create some frames in some canvas, and why can't I send those canvas frames onto the video encoder? And why am I having to fetch a video encoder written in JavaScript to do the same job as the one that's already in the browser written in C?
Right, one of the solutions, because people were like, well, why don't you take this encoder that's written and has been emscripted across?
And it's 5.7 billion TK in size.
I was like, that's half a meg for something that I shouldn't have to actually do myself. I'm going to store them as WAVs. That's what I'm going
to
do.
If you're downloading 500K of JavaScript to do something the browser already does,
That's weird. Yeah. That does not fly well with me.
Speaking of using the most efficient and correct format for things, SVG is a great format for graphics on the web. I thought I'd do a quick, there are our sponsor for this show. It's svgsummit.com. That'll redirect you, get to the right place to go. What is a redirect? What HTTP code is that? Or isn't it one? Is it different?
302.
Oh yeah, 302.
That's 301 really
if it's permanent, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's 305. Yeah, there's a few.
Well, I'm sure they use the right one because it will redirect you. So don't be surprised when you type svgsummit.com in your browser to go to the Environments for Humans website. It's an online conference. You watch it from anywhere in the world where you have, you know, an internet connection and a screen to watch it from. Coming up January 21st, and it's all day, like 9 a.m., 4 p.m. Central, you know, U.S. time. But that translates pretty well to a couple other time zones. Introducing SVG with Ryan Ireland, cracking the SVG code with Brenda Storer, designing complex SVG animations with Sarah Drasner, who's amazing at that kind of thing. I think I'm going to do a thing at the end of it. I'm still kind of working out the details and stuff. But anyway, yeah, these are really fun conferences. You don't need to fly anywhere. You don't need to eat out anywhere. You don't need to book a hotel room anywhere. You just attend it online. But it is live, and you can ask your questions live as well as get the recordings when it's done that you can rewatch at any time in case you need to step out or something like that. These things are pretty fun and stuff. So definitely check out svgsummit.com. Let's see.
No need to fly anywhere. I like this idea because recently I got off a flight. I got to tell you this. I got off a flight and I was waiting for, you know, when the arm is coming down to let you off the flight, and then it's coming down like, and the door's going to, and you can woo. And I was waiting and I had one of my Google hoodies on. And one of the stewardesses, I stood near the door because I like to get off quickly to get through the customs and borders. Straight through. Yeah. No waiting. And she leant around. She saw that I had the Google logo on my hoodie top. And she just went, she said to the other stewardess, she went, I told you they worked for Google. And she was Scottish. I'm not just making up regional accents. And it was fine, you know. I was like, well, this is reasonable. She said, is it just you and the other guy? And I think she meant Paul Kinlan, who's one of our colleagues. And I was like, oh, no, it's Mr. Archibald, Mr. Dutton, Mr. Kinlan, and me. There's the four of us. And the other stewardess, she had this real look of intensity on her face, and she leant in really close to me, and she went, do you have Google underwear? I mean, what do you do with... I mean, that put me off flying.
I would just look her dead in the eyes and go, yes.
I didn't dare do that. The plane was still locked down at that point. You know.
So on that particular flight, the group of us, we'd managed to sort of, like, it was a sort of freak deal. We'd managed to all get into first class on a plane. And I don't think any of us had ever been in first class before. And it was, and we were clearly not.
We're not the usual clientele.
No, because I tend to just try and sleep on flights. And I... so the same, well, judging by the regional accents, the same lady came to me and said, would you like anything to eat, dear? And I...
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire. Are you Virginia Doubtfire, dear?
But like, I said, like, no, I'm okay, I don't want anything. And she said, are you sure? Would you like a wee amoosh boosh? And I had never heard that collection of sounds together in my life.
Amoosh boosh. You've never heard of an amoosh boosh?
No, is that what it is?
It's an amuse-bouche. Amuse-bouche. Yeah.
A round the hoose.
Yeah.
There's an amuse-bouche around the hoose.
No, oh, my goodness.
What? But I couldn't...
What did you do? What did you do? Panic? Because I know what you're like in social situations. You panic, don't you?
Well, there's two choices then. If I say yes, I would like one of your
options.
Bouches.
You're on a plane. There aren't that many options of what an amuse-bouche can be. And she's asked you if you want food.
Is it like a moss-based... food? That's what I'm picturing.
It could have been. It could have been.
Not a little bush. No, it's on.
It's as far as I. It could have been Scottish for a punch in the gut. When in doubt, no, thank you.
Classic Scottish trick there.
Just. Yeah. Yeah. Would you like food? No. How about a punch in the gut? I don't think that's how it works.
Scottish handshake.
Oh my goodness.
Or maybe that'll make you feel less full. I don't know.
So I think we're definitely put off flights, but I think between us, I think so. It's actually come quite good to not fly to do a conference.
Amoosh boosh.
Amoosh boosh.
I almost want to go on another flight to find out what that is. Is it an animal?
No. You could ask them just really awkward questions.
Is it a mineral?
Vegetable? Any? Come on, give me a hint. No. In fact, don't tell me.
How many eyes does an amuse bouche have? How many eyes does a bouche have? Because a mouche sounds like a modifier.
A mouche.
Like there's a bouche? Is it, would you like a bouche or an amuse bouche?
This is like putting like a the G on the end of your regex. You put it, turns it from a mouche to an amuse bouche.
Yeah.
I like it. I don't know what they do, but I feel like this something that should be in ES8 2017. There you go. Have you mooshed this guy?
The amuse operator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. We've completely hijacked your conversation.
I still don't know what it is.
No,
and I don't know what combination of vowels and consonants that
it's
would
kind of like
do
how promises and as an amuse bouche for service workers.
Wow, that was a segue and a half. I commend you, sir. No, it's a little starter. It's a starter for a starter is what it is in terms of meals. It's a starter for your starter. It's like a little It's a palate cleanser. Am I the only person who knew what an amuse-bouche was?
It's a starter for, so if your starter is an animal, you get an amuse-bouche to feed it.
No.
It's a starter for your starter. You can, here you go.
Enjoy that. I'll be eating you shortly. No.
Because that sounds like the kind of thing they do in first class.
That's really hard to do.
Yeah, that sounds like something posh people would get into.
No.
Feeding an animal just to eat it.
Well, as opposed to the rest of us who eat meat.
Oh no, the amuse bouches have got loose. They're all in economy. It doesn't matter. We don't
care. Wow.
All right, fellas. Thanks so much for being on the show. It was amazing. There'll be links to definitions for amuse bouches and all kinds of stuff in the show notes for this thing.
Before we go, Jake, Paul, if people aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And what's one thing you'd like to plug before you leave? We'll start with Jake.
I'm Jaffa the Cake on the Twitters. And if people want to give me money, just look at a mirror and ask yourselves why.
Perfect.
Now that's fair. I would actually question their sanity. Yeah. Wow. There's something you want to plug. Surely it'll be Stream Service Worker or Service Worker with Stream.
Oh yeah, check out Service Worker. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm British.
You're not in sales. You're not in sales either. I can sense that about you, my friend. It's absolutely fine. Neither am I. Hi, okay, I'm Paul. I'm AeroTwist on the Twitter. Thanks for asking. Now, this is a former life of mine where I worked alongside advertising people and I couldn't look myself in the eye anymore. So,
good job. That's not where Google makes its money, eh?
So, you can find me on Twitter at AeroTwist, and there's absolutely nothing I want to plug apart from... Oh, Big Rig. You can find Big Rig if you Google for AeroTwist and then Big Rig. It's basically a tool that will hopefully help you figure out how you're spending your time when you're doing page load or animations or that kind of thing. It kind of tells you, hey, you spent this long in JavaScript and this long in Paint and stuff. And people are finding it, I think, quite helpful. So give that a whirl. Let me know how you get on.
Nice snowflakes on your site. Looking good.
You know what? That code kicks in on December the 1st and it gets rid of itself on December the 31st. And every year I forget I've got it there and you hit it and it's like, hey, look at that snow. Well done, past me. And then you're like somebody tweeted a site yesterday that does exactly the same snowflake effect, except they do them with every snowflake is a DOM element and they use left and they use top and they use set interval to do the animation of the snowflake. So it's like a tour de force of how not to do the snowflake thing. That one happens to be, I believe, just a canvas. But you can do it with transforms. But if you don't know why, you can hit CSStriggers.com. Totally nailed the self-promo, smashing it.
That's much better than me. Well,
there we go.
And if people want to give you money?
They can't. I don't want it. It's fine. They should donate it to actually people who need it. So that would be a better thing to do.
Lovely.
Chris, do you need it?
Not at the moment, but I don't see if the future is a scary place.
Well, my Bitcoin wallet is JFPRKK59. So just send money over there. I appreciate that. Thanks, everyone, for listening and downloading this in your podcatcher's choice. Be sure to star heart it. Go listen to HTTP 203 if you can find it in your podcatcher and subscribe. It's very good. There's also high production videos, which I'm very jealous of. And be sure to visit us at Shop Talk Show and on Twitter and follow us because we have some exciting announcements.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be a gift guide. Check it out.
A little gift guide for you.
At the URL, shoptalkshow.com.